My name is Cameron Hoy. I'm the project manager responsible for the engineering, procurement, and construction. So if there's questions, I'd like to be able to field those. Thank you.
Again, Nick, I'm the development manager. Cameron and I work hand in hand on our projects in Hawaii. I just want to emphasize that we're very early in the process. Wanted to come to you all just to kind of let you know what we're thinking and get your feedback and make sure everyone's included in the discussion. This is the first time we're here. I know Trevor's been here, but the first time Cam and I are here, but certainly it's not going to be the last. So as we move forward, we start studies on the site, we find what we find, and then we come back and report and you know, adjust to go from there. The way the presentation's set up is I'm gonna talk a little bit about the solar, and then Trevor's gonna talk about the archaeological process in the GPR. Given, you know, I think I'm gonna go a little bit fast on the solar piece. So feel free to, you know, stop me if you want to ask a question, or after the meeting if you want to talk to me. My contact info is also here, so fully available to answer any questions if I skip over something or maybe go a little bit too fast. Just a little bit about who we are. AES is a Fortune 500 power company. It's been active in Hawaii for over 25 years. Cameron and I work for the Distributed Energy Group, so we focus primarily on solar and solar plus storage. We have 250 projects across the United States, several of which are on four of the Hawaiian islands. And you can see here an illustration of where we have projects in Hawaii. Three projects in development right now, one on Oahu, one on the Big Island, the one here that we're talking about today. And then we also have 47 megawatts of the same type of project on Kauai, one of which has been operational since December, the other which is under construction right now. I'm not gonna do like a solar and storage basics just because we don't, you know, I wanna get to the burials and the testing process and kind of have a discussion around that. But I'll just talk briefly and show a bunch of photos about our Kauai project that went online in December, because it's an identical project in terms of the technology as to what we're proposing here. So we'll show you photos and it'll, I think, give you a good idea of what it's gonna look like here. So I brought a whole bunch of photos. I'm not gonna comment on all of them. You can see them if you grab the handout, but you can see here in the top left corner what the panels look like. These are unique in that they follow the sun throughout the day, very gradually. Most solar systems, the other big solar projects on Maui, are just fixed tilt. They stay at the same angle, they don't move. These projects, they stay flat at night, and then they wake up in the morning, face east, and then slowly follow the sun until it sets. These projects also incorporate batteries, which is a big part of creating a reliable grid going forward. There's a lot of distributed generation in Hawaii. There's a lot of solar. And basically the power company has come out and said, like, we don't need this much. It hasn't been managed up until the last year. So we're introducing technology that includes batteries so that when everyone comes home from work at 5 o'clock, turns on their appliances, that's when the grid really needs the power. And so we can store the power in the batteries and then dispatch it when MECO actually needs it. It's called load shifting. Here you can see a close-up of the panels going on the trackers. Plenty of space between the rows, high enough off the ground that people or farm livestock can graze beneath. On Kauai, we did a kind of a dual agriculture approach, which was a little bit unique in that, you know, the solar is operating, but at the same time, there's grazing that's still active on the site. So it was well received for, you know, among other reasons, the fact that we continued using it for farming while we introduced, or while we also had solar on the site as well. Here's a good one of the whole site. I guess, Kent, what do you want to say about that? There's actually not as much disturbance. You know, you look at that and it's a big project, but as far as the soil goes, these projects don't involve a lot of ground disturbance. I mean, it depends on the topography, which here, it's a flat site, so there's really not much mass grading that's going to be involved with it, which I think is very important to mention. There's not a huge amount of concrete involved, which is very important. And at the end of 25 years, I'll talk about this process, but there's a decommissioning rule, and we've posted a bond in the event, you know, in 25 years, that if Maui Electric wants to decommission the facility, we could pull everything out and recycle it.
How large is the area?
This project was approximately 250 acres. The project off Kualani Highway is approximately 500. Yeah.
What's your approximate depth for your footings for each solar panel string, and also some questions about that?
Yeah, so for the panel, the trackers sit on piles, just in HP. Yeah, so it just gets pounded right into the ground.
What depth?
To be determined, typically.
And then your lines run through the structure of the solar panel or underground?
Yeah, everything's hung on the structure, and then we only use the roadways for disturbance of digging. We're going to 3 foot is the code, and then we have to go another foot for that trenching, so it's 4 feet that we're disturbing only in very limited areas.
And your storage battery banks, their concrete pads have to have a compaction below it, like to a certain depth for the pad.
Yeah, it's about 18 inches, and then we put a lift on that, it's a step up, so it's about 8-inch step up onto.
But below some surface is 18 inches, you think?
Yes, and it's. There will be some conduit on there, so I'm just going to stay 3 feet right now.
Okay.
But they're 100 feet by 40 feet. And on. So, it's a fairly large concrete pad, but it's a floating pad in the fact that it's not super.
Port on site.
Port on site.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's keep rolling. That's just another aerial shot.
Yeah, dude, can I just make a comment on this one though?
Yeah.
As you can see all the grass underneath the array? That's what I was trying to explain. Nothing is underground there. Yet we bring all the electric into a center and then carry it out for underground. So it's minimal disturbance is what we're trying to summarize here for you. All
right, so I mean, let's talk a little bit about this project that we're here in Maui. HECO put out a RFP 2018 requesting renewables paired with battery storage for the reason that I explained earlier. You may be aware the state has a target of 100% renewable by 2045, so this RFP was a means to drive that process. A number of developers bid in, 8 projects were selected. AES was awarded 3, one here that we're talking about today, one on the Big Island in Waikoloa, and then one on the West Oahu campus in Kapolei. So for Maui, AES and MECO executed the power purchase agreement in December. PUC approved it in March. Under the contract, AES is delivering the power for 25 years and 8 cents. Now, don't get excited, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to sell the power to you for 8 cents, but there are they did produce some estimates that as to what the average consumer can expect to save, and there are savings. So, but we're selling it to them at the lowest cost power purchase agreement that's ever been done in the state. And this is actually unique in that's renewables for less than the cost of fossil fuels, which has always been the argument that fossil fuels are so much cheaper, renewables are too expensive. That argument kind of goes away here because we're selling solar power for less than the cost of fossil fuels. MECO produced these statistics when we filed with the PUC. The energy that would be produced from this facility will offset the energy use of 27,000 homes on Maui, which is an enormous amount. It's 15% of the island's overall electric load. So it's a big project. It offsets a sizable amount of load, and it's all with renewables, which, you know, is hopefully folks see as a good thing. Additionally, it'll eliminate almost 2 million barrels of fuel that's imported to the island over the course of the 25-year term. So a lot of environmental benefits from this project. All right, I'm just going to touch briefly on the location. Trevor's going to get more into the details on this, but you can see the purple line is the project boundary. I think that's drawn at like 690 acres. We're not planning on using more than 500. And honestly, as things kind of become more efficient, like I said, we're super early in the design process. We're trying to use as little as possible. So we have no incentive to take up more space than we absolutely have to. We want to bring it in to as tight of the system as possible. This particular parcel was selected. So this is Mahipono land now, previously A and B. We chose this land because, one, there's a high voltage transmission line that runs literally right through it. Two, the soils are classified as low grade D&E. So we're still gonna look to incorporate a secondary ag use here. But you know, this isn't like class A soils literally right to the right of it. You know, it's class A, so we're not interested in tying up that type of ag land. Again, on the project, just an overview, 200,000 panels. It's the tracker system, follows the sun throughout the day. We talked about the I-beams. Again, just really minimal site disturbance. We're not looking at concrete footings. We're not looking at, you know, shipping in thousands of tons of concrete. There's no mass excavation. It's, you know, by development standards, it's pretty low maintenance. Let's keep moving. And I mentioned decommissioning. So I think this is an important thing to really drive home. There's a bond in place that AES posted so that at the end of 25 years, you know, the money's there to pull the system down and recycle it if that's what the community chooses to do. The panels are, you know, are supposed to be at least 80% as efficient in year 25 as they were in year one. So you could hypothetically continue to use the system. There's no like rapid drop off in year 26. It's still functioning. It's still great, degrading at the same, you know, 1% or less a year. But you know, the community has the option to, if, you know, the project, if you want the project to go, it could easily be disassembled and recycled. Here's the preliminary rendering. I showed you the parcel area. But just to kind of give you an overlay, that's Kualani Highway on the northern part, and Waikapu Stream runs through there. So we're obviously set off from that. Waihee Ditch running kind of from northeast to southwest. We're set off that. But I guess the point here I just want to make is that this is super preliminary. We're just starting testing, and if testing yields evidence, then this can be adjusted. As far as where we are right now, and kind of give you an idea of the schedule, we're in the community feedback and consultation phase, so that's part of why we're here. We had a community meeting in December that was well attended and got some good feedback then. And you know, Trevor's been doing some one-on-one meetings with a lot of you. And you know, like I said, we're here now and just wanted to make you formally aware of the project, get your input, and you know, as we continue, we'll you know certainly report back. The plan is to start construction in 2020, sometime in 2020, and to hopefully be online by 2021 or 2022.
From cultural surveys. I just want to give you an overview on the process that we've started and where we're going with this project. We've only just started with some preliminary research and consultation. We did our homework, did our background research, and conducted a reconnaissance level inspection of the project area. We started community consultation with knowledgeable individuals from the community, many of which regularly attend the council here, many were in the audience earlier. And then because of certain things I'll talk about later on in the presentation, we conducted a preliminary GPR survey, and I'll share some details of that. And then at the end, I'll go through next steps of where we are. We're coming to you, the community first, the burial council first, before we initiate with SHPD. We are planning to do a cultural impact assessment and an inventory survey, but preceded by an inventory survey plan that will document all of our methods and consultation process. And depending on results, we'll talk about mitigation, monitoring plans, other things beyond that. So very early. So in terms of background research, just a real quick summary. This is the area of Kama'oma'o, Wandering Place of Spirits. There are no LCAs recorded in this area. It's part of a large land purchase in 1875 by a Waikuku sugar plantation. There's very few maps that show great detail of this area, unfortunately, unlike other areas of Maui. We do have this 1885 map that shows a road extending through the southern portion of our project area and a road or trail extending through the northern part of our project area. So that's one of the real features that show on the map. Historically, this area was used for commercial agriculture, 1880s until 2016. To make that happen, especially in kind of these lower grade soils, and there's a lot of water control infrastructure that was installed to move water to this area. We do think there's some level of soil conditioning occurring where they're bringing in materials, mineral-rich materials, water-absorbing materials to mix in with the plow zone. And based on our work in the vicinity, in other agricultural areas, former A&B land, we know that the plow zone is most likely 3 to 4 feet deep in an area where everything on the surface has probably been disturbed. Everything within 3 or 4 feet has been churned up by a plow over the last 100 years or so. As part of our research, we investigate what previous studies have been done in the area. So this map shows previous archaeological studies that have occurred in the vicinity. There have been no studies conducted previously in our project area, but there have been a number to the northwest related to commercial residential development, many we've talked about here today. In terms of findings, we also research and plot the locations of historic properties through previous archaeological studies. There have been no historic properties identified in our project area to date, but this map shows that there have been a number of historic properties found in the vicinity. The red triangles denote burial sites. You can see the linear concentration of burials extending along the dune as well as some outliers and other site types, temporary habitation site, fire pit, and of course, Waiheke Ditch. So as part of our field inspection, which is just preliminary at this time, we walked through the project area. We did find a number of possible historic properties. The Waiheke Ditch extends through our project area that already has a state site number. There's some water control features that I'll show some photos of, and a storage building, some sediment mounds that we'll talk about in more detail, a berm that has some utilities in it, an unimproved road, which is older than 50 years, so we're interested in that, and then a scatter of cane slag, which is the byproduct of sugarcane production, an area of that we'll investigate further. A couple photos of our findings. Upper left, number 6, is the sediment berm that has some utilities poking out of it. We'll investigate that more, but I think it's related to these utilities. Number 1 in the top center, that's one of the water control features. So this seems to be a filtering mechanism that's filtering off sediment and other material from the water that's flowing there. 4 is the structure that we found. It's a galvanized metal shack. 2B is a reservoir on the property that's no longer in use. It's lined with plastic or fabric. And then number 5 are the sediment mounds. It's not entirely clear here. It's something that we will be investigating further as part of our study. I think these mounds may be related to that soil conditioning where they're dumping more mineral-rich material into the project area and then working it into the plow zone. As part of community consultation, I threw this up there just so everyone knows that there are requirements for consultation under certain conditions. So here we have the administrative rules, the conditions being discussions with SHPD, background research, or public input indicate a need to consult with knowledgeable individuals. So we think that this project meets those criteria. We started with consultation letters submitted to a number of individuals that we know are connected to this area. We followed up with them. We scheduled and conducted some talk stories, sit-down meetings, phone calls to gather information at this point and just initiate that process. We're doing this presentation now. We are planning to do a broader consultation in the cultural impact assessment, which will involve the same individuals as well as other organizations throughout the island. And then we plan on providing ongoing updates as we move forward. So this slide is just a broad summary of the consultation, the results of consultation. So knowledgeable individuals that we consulted with had knowledge of the trails, battles, and burial sites in central Maui. The significance and importance of Kamaʻomaʻo as a wandering or leaping place of spirits. Even though there are no LCAs found in our project area, the reminder that there still could be habitation and homesteads in this area. There was a strong community interest in the use of ground-penetrating radar, and a recommendation to further investigate those mounds in our project area. There was a request for archaeological monitoring during all ground-moving activities or earth-moving activities, and preservation in place of burials, of course, is kind of without saying that that's the clear request. There were environmental concerns that were raised, and hopefully this presentation starts to address those. Interest in participating in the CIA, interest in this type of presentation and presentations about project-specific details, and we also receive referrals to other knowledgeable individuals and descendants of Waikapu. So this is just a real intro slide to GPR. Upper left corner is one of my coworkers pushing our GPR machine. It consists of a parent antenna that rolls around on the ground connected to a modified jogging baby stroller and an onboard computer.
That's what it looks like.
This is purchased directly from the manufacturer. It's not something that we've produced. The upper right corner is just a real basic graphic of how GPR works. The parrot, it's described as a parrot antenna because one half of the antennas sends radar waves into the ground. These waves bounce off of objects, layers, things, and some of them, or hopefully most of them, bounce back and return to a collecting antenna within the machine. That whole process happens in nanoseconds, and it happens millions of times as we do the survey. Lower left-hand corner is a snapshot directly from the manufacturer of GPR, indicating why we chose the 400 megahertz shielded antenna for this work. So it is described for archaeological applications. It does show a depth range according to the manufacturer of 0 to 4 meters, 0 to 12 feet. That's really dependent on conditions. Could be greater or lesser than that depth, depending on conditions and favorability. So the next slide, this is perhaps the most important, one of the most important. So the Natural Resource Conservation Service and others have put out maps that distinguish the suitability of GPR based on soil types. Upper left is Maui, showing areas of green and dark green as high to very high suitability for the use of GPR, and then down the list until we get to purple, we're in areas that are unsuited. The soil has a lot to do with those factors. GPR likes dry environments, away from the water table. It is affected by salt, so near the ocean, it's not as effective. It likes homogeneous materials that don't have a lot of other material mixed in. So what we see as we focus in on our project area is that we are in an area of high to very high suitability for the use of GPR. And that's one of the main reasons we're interested in its use here and in Central Mecca. So we conducted a preliminary GPR survey of four small areas in our project area, just to start out with, to see what the results were. We asked a few early questions. Can GPR identify stratigraphy, layers of soil, and the depth of the plow zone? Can GPR identify anomalies at this location? And how can we use this technology during the AIS? Of course, the purpose of the AIS is to identify historic properties. Our initial survey included four 25 by 25 meter grids spaced out in four different environments within our project area. This was a little bit more than half an acre total, 26,000 feet per square feet. The way that we do the survey, which will be shown in further slides, is that instead of running just the GPR one time or one time in one area, we do a number of transects that are connected together to create a three-dimensional grid so that we can look at that. So you'll see examples. So this project included 404 transects, 101 per grid, which totaled 6.4 miles of walking with our baby stroller out there. So the first thing we do is we have to establish a grid. So this is us setting up one of the four areas. The area was just cleared of vegetation with no ground disturbance, so we just had to make a nice clear surface to work on. We laid out our individual transects in this area. So there's 101 pin flags on both sides of the grid. Each one of those is one transect that we'll walk with the machine. And then the lower right corner is us laying out one transect and recording with the machine one of the 101 transects at this location. So we take that information that's recorded by our antenna and an onboard computer. We bring it back to the office, and this is what GPR data looks like. On the left-hand side, we have a reflection profile. So just if you've seen hand-drawn profiles in our archaeological reports, this is what we're producing. We're looking at the ground as if we've excavated down, looking at it in front of us. And then with this, the technology that we use, we can combine all of those transects together to create a three-dimensional model. So on the right-hand side, we have this model that we can sit at our computers and excavate downward sideways. We can look at things in all different ways in this model. So it may be new to what people have experienced with GPR in the past. I think in earlier surveys, it was just running transects, marking anomalies, testing those anomalies without the analysis portion of the work. So we get to one of our first questions: can GPR identify stratigraphy depth of plow zone in our project area? And my answer would be yes. Here's two examples that pretty clearly show, without much knowledge of GPR profiles, that we have a very different signal shown in the ground between the plow zone, the upper portion of the profile, and interfaces or buried layers. And then at the very end, at least in this location, we get some horizontal banding or noise that's probably reflecting from what I imagine is lithified sand or limestone underneath bedrock. Next question would be, can GPR identify anomalies in the project area? So these are just some examples I pulled. This is two images from the exact same area. On the top, we see that profile view, and we can look and see some GPR anomalies here. The farther left arrow is more of a classic GPR hyperbola, showing that raised area that's unique from the surrounding. We see a long linear anomaly extending across the profile, and then we see two vertical anomalies that are very strongly shown on this profile. So those are the kind of things that we're looking for. I think even without a whole lot of GPR knowledge, those stand out to anyone looking at that information. If we turn the model to look down, like from space, this is the model. We excavated down to the surface of the plow zone, and here we see the linear anomaly and what it looks like in the GPR data. So we have this 80-foot long linear anomaly shown in GPR, and we don't know what it is at this point. It could be something natural, like a former channel of White Pooh Stream, which is nearby. It could be related to soil formation, but now we have a target for it, and we can go out there and test that location and make a determination of what it is. And we'll talk a little bit about that.
Can you tell us when you find out?
Yeah, absolutely. So how can we use this for this AIS? So I just kind of got into that. We can, the GPR will provide us with targets for our testing instead of a more random sampling of our strategy. So that's an important part of it. We are in the very early stages of the use of GPR on a broader scale, and this project will give us some ground truth examples of GPR, so we can then compare, this is what it looked like in the GPR, this is what we found, and then through that, hopefully, sometime in the future, we can use that information to interpret what we're seeing. So then we can push the GPR and make interpretations without the excavation component in some locations.
Right.
Yeah. So I went over this a little bit, but next steps, we are planning to initiate consultation with SHPD from an agency at SHPD. We've already talked about we're going to do the whole process, so hopefully it's an easy decision on their side. We're planning to do everything here. We will be starting the cultural impact assessment, and we are going to work up an archaeological inventory survey plan. We'll talk about how we'll be doing a 100% surface survey. That's just part of the requirements. And then we'll be working with the people we've consulted with and SHPD to develop a strategy that includes a mix of GPR and test excavation. Again, it's geographically a large project, but ground disturbance is minimal, so our focus is really on the areas that will be disturbed by the project. And following that, there'll be an inventory survey report. and with recommendations and assessment of historic properties, which could lead to mitigation plans. We're already assuming that monitoring will be part of the project, regardless of our findings. And yeah, we'll go from there. Hope to keep you updated through the whole process.
Trevor, those samples you showed me, what was the depths again that you were more confident in its accuracy?
The manufacturer says 0 to 12 feet, 0 to 4 meters.
And then you'll probably be operating within 3 feet for the footings for the.
Yeah.
And then 18 inches for the pad for your solar banks, your
right.
battery banks. So.
Right. I think what we're seeing for the most part here is that GPR is penetrating to what is probably either a liquefied sand, limestone, bedrock area.
Yeah.
So I think the coverage is pretty good here.
So the GPR that you're going to do is going to be isolated to areas where you're going to do a foundation or a footing? Because you'd have to open up large areas, clear them in order to do larger sections of the property.
Right. I think because it's already a relatively cleared area, I think there might be some mowing that has to occur in order to complete the GPR.
Yeah.
But they'll need to do some mowing for the project anyway. Just
I guess what percentage, because it's a large parcel, what percentage of that is going to be GPR?
So that's something that we'll be developing as part of the plan. Yeah. Just the small areas that were shown on the one map. Our four small areas, that was like 6.4 miles of GPR. So large areas do take a large amount of effort. So we just want to balance that in a reasonable way between GPR testing, our surface survey, and everything else that we do, and monitoring.
So like, your footings are pretty narrow. It looks pretty narrow for the structure to support the solar cell, the panels. So you could kind of just follow those lines, I guess, right? And they're pretty linear, kind of go along that whole path.
Right.
It helps direct you in, I mean, wherever's going to face the most amount of impact. So
right.
It's make the most sense. But,
yeah.
How many battery banks were you folks looking to install?
96. There's clustered in sets of four, so it's.
So that pad was all 96 on one large pad?
No. It's 24 pads.
24 pads.
Yeah, you can see them in the white locations on that rendering. So there's not 96 locations, there's 24. So they'll be combined together.
How many per pad?
Four per pad.
Four, oh, sorry. Four.
Yeah. Yeah, and about the linear you were talking about, roadways and how they connect to one another, you can see these lines in between. That's where the trenching goes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we disturb. And I wanted to share something with the 200 acre site or so in Kauai. We disturbed 2 acres of that, generally. I mean, as in where we actually used excavation. The system's able to follow the contours of that land, which makes, you know, mass grading, we're not mass grading. So
you guys are running conduit, or are you guys capping in like my electric when it comes to your trenching, your electrical lines trenched?
The DC will be all direct carrier, direct current cables. DC and the AC current, which is a higher voltage. This one will be like 35 kV. So that will go into conduit.
Okay.
Is that running underground?
The AC and DC will run underground, but concentrated on these roadways and lines. The rest of how each solar panel connects together, and then what these things are, they're strung together, kind of like Christmas trees, if you will, or Christmas tree lights. The long line running down the tracker is above ground, hung on that on the structure. So there's no need for maybe what you've seen in the past of other solar. The reason why this one's unique is that all of that's above ground, and we're only trenching like long runs along the roadway, which then become our roadway. You know, compact, backfill, and then it becomes our main ways through the site.
I guess what I forgot to ask was, are you held to the same depth as MECO when it comes to electrical lines? So what is your depth going to be when you do trench it, turn it into a roadway?
I imagine it would be the same. I mean, they're going by the NEC, right?
Okay.
So
what is it?
Three feet. It should be 36 inches.
Yeah. The hope is to keep as much as we can in the plow zone, avoiding the undisturbed area underneath.
And the plow zone for that sample was how deep?
3 to 4 feet.
So you trench the 4 feet, and then you lay the, you actually put like a fill in, a native, you know, screen it, and then put a layer of dirt.
Compaction.
Right, compact that, then put it. So when we say 36 inches, that's where the cables will be, but we're actually excavating one more foot. Just to be like really clear.
No, thanks for the transparency.
Yeah.
You know, our question before.
Are you talking about why?
If they find an anomaly.
So how these systems work is it doesn't really like touch the residential.
And that's the part that
goes into the overall. And we're supplying power at a rate. So the utility, in savings, it would be more savings that they're not burning deep, hundreds and thousands of diesel, and they're not barging in diesel fuel. So the rate doesn't go up, it stays static. So as the price of oil and gas goes up and down, this is a steady rate over 25 years. So the savings comes in avoided cost of.
Okay, I think we're gonna, can we table that and maybe have that discussion outside?
Sorry, I'm like,
it's 2:30. And mahalo for that presentation. Did you want to add?
Yeah, mahalo
to
that thing.
No,
almost. Okay, good. Thank you so much, mahalo. Kaika, do we have anyone else who is presenting on the other agenda item?
There's a couple. Yeah. They were invited. We notified them that it was on the agenda. I don't know if they're here to present on it, but I do know that Noelani did sign up to testify about the agenda item.
The which one is it?
The letter, yeah.
Yeah, the letter. So it's going to be agenda item D. Yeah.
I'll be super, super brave.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
And what are we limited to again, Kaika?
So, right now we don't have quorum, so council members can ask questions, they just can't talk to each other.
We can't talk to each other.
Amongst each other.
Oh. Okay. Turn to stone.
Take him literally.
Okay.
Aloha. All I want to say about, I'm not even sure why this is on the agenda, because it was on the agenda before, and then I believe the AG said we couldn't even speak about it. So I'm really not sure, do you know who put it on the agenda? Or why it came up on the agenda? Was it requested by the developers to be on the agenda?
My understanding, that letter was sent to SHB to be forwarded to the Borough Council, therefore as correspondence.
It came up. This was on the agenda back in March. Anyways, I'm just wondering why it's on the agenda at all. My only testimony about this is that it's hilariously colonial for foreign developers to think that they can challenge the Mo'opua'ahau of Kanaka when they themselves have no Mo'opua'ahau to this place and they have no Kuleana to this place. So I just like to know. Where they get off thinking that they can come inside here and talk about their own, they mention in their letters their interest. But I'd like to point out that development has no interest to burials. They hold the burials in trust for the descendants. That is all I have to say. Thank you.
Anybody else want to testify?
You signed up, Claire.
I will be also very brief. I just want to alert you to a very dangerous situation that's happening, because this is also happening at Kauai Hall Church. They are challenging the church is challenging the Kalikini family, the descendants who have become recognized as lineal descendants. And as we know, at the Kauai Hau Church, it's been like 6 years, 7 years that they have had to stop their project because they, the judge ruled that they broke all the laws. But the Kupuna have not been reinterred, and the family members, all the recognized descendants, do not want them to build a building there. They want their Kupuna to go back in, into the Lepo that they came from. But then the church lost the Lepo, and so it's dangerous, I think, to be in a cemetery. But this it's not that it's never happened before, but it just happens, and the people who stand to gain by not letting people be descendants, it's a really dangerous thing, and I hope that you guys would see that maybe we should object to them being able to do that. And by what standard do they get to object to somebody's descendancy recognized by a burial council? So, thank you, that's all. Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll table or defer the other items on, or what?
Lorelai signed up to speak on the item.
Was there something else?
Was it
the same thing? Oh, it's all the same. It's their lawyer's letter, my lawyer's letter, I said right.
Okay.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that's fine. You guys.
Okay, mahalo to everyone for coming.
Mahalo. And mahalo na kumea ai.
Yeah, mahalo na kumea.
That was necessary at that
point. Save my life. What is the next meeting, Kaika?
So the next Barrow Council meeting will be...
Okay, we are all... in June, it's that...
June 19th.
Might not be.
Oh, I am here.
Let me see.
Okay, I'm here. I thought I was going to be
third Wednesday.
No, I'm going on a
couple of them will be here, yeah.
Oh, I thought I wasn't going to be here on that.
219, never again.